Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Stephen Dominguez. Stephen is the co-host, along with Ben Dorst, of the Pure BS podcast. He is also the co-founder of the BS Podcast Network. Today we're going to hear how the books Stephen has read have helped him to understand the world and his place within it. Well, thanks, Stephen. I so appreciate you being here. And I guess I'm just wondering off the bat what your earliest memories of reading are.
Reading or being read to?
Being read to is fine. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was very small, every night my father would read to me from these hardback Sesame Street books. And he would do the voices of the characters. And that was like an every night thing. And I think that really got me into the whole reading thing in general, was just these awesome books every single night without fail. So that's my earliest memory.
And then what were the first books that you got in? Like, do you remember learning to read and the books that got you really inspired as you were learning to read?
I remember in kindergarten doing like the little like worksheets and stuff, like with the words and things like that. The first like series that I was able to read on my own was The Boxcar Children.
Oh yeah.
And that was really cool because you had this group of four kids who are off on their own, away from, you know, parental figures, kind of in their own little clubhouse, solving their own little mysteries. And everyone had, it was a different age ranges. So you kind of, as I grew, I kind of latched onto the, you know, different characters. And then from there, and I want to say third, fourth grade, something like that, Goosebumps was huge.
Yeah. What made you interested in Goosebumps? Those were so hugely popular. I think they still are, I imagine.
I imagine, yeah, there was just a movie that came out recently with Jack Black, I believe.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was just a, you know, you're that age and just kind of the whole like creepy, mysterious, icky kind of stuff kind of appeals to, I don't know, young boys or young kids in general. Maybe it was just that everyone else was reading them too. I don't know, but I remember that first book called Welcome to Dead House. And that was incredibly creepy to me.
What's the plot? Do you remember? I haven't read it myself.
Oh, let me think back. It was a family that moves into an old house. And I believe it's a haunted house. It's a ghost story. But I don't remember besides that what exactly was going on in the book. Because that one seemed to me, if I'm remembering correctly, a very straightforward, you know, haunted house kind of book. There's some, you know, things go bump in the night and things are creepy. But every other Goosebump book after that kind of had like a weird shtick to it. Like there was Monster Blood, which was like this weird slime that just kept growing and growing and enveloping things. There was one about a summer camp. I don't remember the name of it, but that book introduced me to like the plot twist at the end. So spoilers for this Goosebumps book, if anyone hasn't read it yet, but
I think enough time has passed. I think it's on them now. I think we can let it go.
Okay. It was this book. I don't know if it was called just Summer Camp or Welcome to Summer Camp or you know, there was always some weird pun in the title, but this whole book, it seems like it's a werewolf book where, you know, there's they're out of summer camp and there's a monster going around and it's furry or something, or I don't know, like kids are running from it and hiding and it's creeping around. And then at the very end of the book, and this just flipped my lid as a kid, they look up into the sky and mention that that's Earth up there and one day they're going to go and visit it or something.
What?
It was just a very bizarre twist. And like, I was just like, what? You can do this?
That's insane. And were you reading these books like at night? Like, did you ever get in a situation where you kind of freaked yourself out enough that you couldn't sleep?
You know, not really. I think part of having books read to me maybe at night helped, but from an early age, like I kind of, my parents were always very clear on this is fiction and this is truth. And fiction was like, don't worry about it. It's fake. It's not real. And so I kind of grew up with like, okay, fiction is one thing. I can kind of put that in a little box, you know, a not real box, don't have to worry about it box. And so, no, I never really, I'll put it this way. It was very, very rare that a book would actually freak me out enough to have trouble sleeping. Not so with TV shows like Unsolved Mysteries. To this day, I can't listen to that theme. I have to turn it off and walk away.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. And I wonder if that's because it's a different sensory experience. Like you're hearing the theme song and it's like making you feel a certain way versus if you read the same story in a book, would it have the same effect on you?
Yeah, it's got to be a sense thing. It just brings back all the old creepy memories. And yeah, I don't know. And you know, books too, a lot of it for me, you know, it's a movie playing inside my own head, right? When I'm reading a book, I'm picturing the environment, the scene, the characters, and it's all through the filter of my own experiences. So something really creepy that's being explained in my own head, I might translate it as not being so creepy. Maybe that's a fail safe or something, so I don't, you know, freak myself out or whatever. But when I read a book and then go back and read it again later, depending on the amount of time that's passed, I'll kind of go back to those past memories and they just seem kind of like, oh, maybe this book wasn't quite as good as I remembered because in my own head, it's not the same. Or it's, how do I explain this? Okay. For example, the book Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1993, 94, something like that, you know, everybody suddenly Jurassic Park was everywhere. You know, the movie was huge and all that. And as a kid, I got way into that. And so I read the novel, of course. And that is one book that I keep going back to every 5 to 10 years. I'll read it again. And over the years, I've kind of realized, you know, every stage I get something else out of the book because so much time has passed between them. But in my head, some of those scenes are still the same as how I imagined them the first time around. Like there was one scene where it was Grant, Lex, and Tim in an inflatable raft, and the T-Rex is coming for them, and they're in like this lake area, and they're trying to get to the river part so that they'll speed up, and the T-Rex kind of just slowly wades into the lake, and Grant comments on how its tail is moving like an alligator's or something like that. And like that image has always stuck with me in my own head. It's the same way every time I read that book.
But what I'm wondering, I'm really fascinated when you say that when you go back and you've read it at different times in your life, you notice different things or different things speak to you about the book. Can you think of any those differences at different readings at different times in your life?
Like one of the first times I read it, you know, I really identified with Lex and Tim, you know, specifically for this Jurassic Park example, because they're the kids of the book. And so as a kid yourself, you relate to their peril. You know, they want to see their parents again and they're in a strange place. And these adults are kind of a, you know, they're pseudo parental people. But then you read it later and you go, man, those kids are annoying. You know, as the adult, it's like, I got to keep these kids alive. You know, it's little things like that. Kind of maybe more on the technical end, like I was able to understand more of the science of what was going on. So that was like, maybe that's the next step up is then in high school age, I was able to kind of more understand like the genetics of it and what they were doing there and very, you know, the technical side of it. And then I read it again, you know, a few years after high school. And that's when I understood more of like the business aspect of it. Like this park was built, you know, for money and people had to do underhanded things to get it to work right. Hammond wasn't this nice old man. He was, you know, he was a businessman. He did what he had to do to try to make a buck. And so just every time I go back to it, I just get this other little little facet of the story.
So is it like you become, you less emotionally identify with the characters as you reread it? Because it seems like the more you reread it, the more you kind of take a step back and say, like, kind of look at it pragmatically, as much as you can look at A World of Dinosaurs pragmatically.
For me, The World of Dinosaurs is very real.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
Well, and I think, so the first few times I read it, you know, the characters, you know, the main point of that story is you're following these characters' lives. And a lot of stories, maybe that's just what I latch on to, those types of stories where you're following these characters and their thoughts and emotions and their trials and tribulations and all that good stuff. And so I think early on, I kind of nailed that down. I nailed down, okay, I know who these characters are. I know what their motivations are. And then, you know, on a very surface level, you know, the action, adventure, and drama that gets them from the beginning to the end. And that's kind of then done, I guess, in my own head.
Hmm.
So then the next time I read, you know, that's already done. I've already processed that, I guess. I don't know. And so then I'm able to kind of pay closer attention to some of the other details that before I kind of glossed over to get to the next action beat to see what was going to happen to these characters.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, we were talking before we kind of got off track, and a very good track, but we were talking about Goosebumps when I imagine you were in elementary school still. So I don't want to miss any of the books that come sort of after that that meant a lot to you.
Goosebumps was a very good transition to the world of Stephen King.
Hmm.
There were a lot of, I read a lot. There was, besides Goosebumps, there was also, what were they called? Was it Fudge? There's a book series, something about Fudge, and that was like the little brother.
Oh, sure, but, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. There was a few of them. There were two or three of those. I recall a book called Ribsy about a dog. That's about all I can remember from that. Tail, was it? Oh, I know. Aliens Ate My Homework.
Is that it?
No. I'm sorry. My Teacher's an Alien. that's what it was. Okay. So there's this book called My Teacher's an Alien, and it was one of those like Scholastic book club situations
mm-hmm.
where they give you that really thin, you know, foldable papery thing, and you check off the books you want, and then you go to your parents and you beg them. And luckily my parents were always like, you know, you don't need that toy, but I'll buy you this book. They were those kind of people.
Totally. I've never been as excited in my life as I was awaiting the Scholastic book fair.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I mean, thinking about it now as adults, we're both kind of like, oh my God, like.
It was an event.
It was. It totally was.
So this one year, I'm looking through this thing, and they wouldn't have the cover art for every single book, but certain ones would be on there, and you could see the artwork. And there was one, and it was called My Teacher's an Alien, and the cover was very realistic. It wasn't cartoony. It looked like, you know, the kids are peeking around a corner and there's an adult and they've just pulled their mask off, and it's a very like gray alien type alien, the typical like kind of a larger head, big eyes. But the thing that got me was that it looked real. It didn't look like, you know, cartoony, funny, you know, kiddie book. It's like, oh, this looks like a real book. And so that was one of the ones that I asked for, and I got it. And that book, I didn't read for a long time because the cover scared me.
So that was one that scared you. Before you even read it, the cover just freaked you out.
The cover freaked me out. And that's got to be more that visual component of things, like how the unsolved mysteries and, you know, all that. You know, I see this alien thing and it just creaked me out. I put it back in the bookshelf. I don't remember for how long. It seems to me like it was years, but it was probably a couple of months or something until I finally pulled it off the shelf and read it. And it was a fantastic book. I remember really enjoying it. The main character was a kind of this daydreamy kid and just, you know, not really being satisfied with life. And then he finds out the secret that his teacher's this alien, and him and his buddy go and try and figure out what the deal is. But then that turned into a book series. What were they called?
I think there's one that's like My Teacher Fried My Brains or something like that. Like they have very intense titles.
But the cover artwork turned cartoony on me. I remember that. So every book kind of introduced a new teacher or alien or something. And then they end up going on this grand, you know, galactic adventure. I don't even remember how it wrapped up or even if I finished the series. I don't remember, but so it went from Goosebumps to that. And I reread those books quite a few times. The teacher's an alien, fried my brain, saw that.
What was it about those books you think that made you keep returning to them or drew you to them in the first place?
Well, obviously the imagery drew them to me in the first place, just that scary picture. But I think going back to it, it was the kid who is unsatisfied with life. He's a daydreamer, which that was me. I was always a daydreamer. And kind of was unsatisfied and looking for, like, there's something else here. There's something else in this life to get to. And even now as an adult, like I have that niggling feeling in the back of my head, like, am I missing out on something? Is there something else like I could be doing or should be doing or that I'm meant to be doing? So I think as a kid, you read this story and this kid has those feelings and then something happens. So then he's able to, you know, act on the, like, oh, there is something else going on. There are, you know, these aliens and these vast galactic civilizations, and I get to explore them. And isn't that great and fun? So that must be why I kept going back to it. And probably because I had not yet discovered Star Wars. So
yeah, that'll take up a lot of your time.
Yeah. Well, once that hit, I mean, that's still going. That's Star Wars.
Oh man. So after that series, so you're in roughly like still grade school, if you're going to the Scholastic Book Fair, finding that out, was Stephen King your next big sort of book interest, or where did it go next for you as a daydreamer?
Yeah. The next one was Stephen King. And I'm trying to remember what was the first Stephen King book that I read that was like, oh, this was good. I want to read more from this guy. Because there was a point when I started going to the library.
So you didn't go as a kid?
No, I don't really remember. Well, okay, I remember going as a child and getting like the dinosaur books. Like, this is pre-Jurassic Park. I was always kind of a dinosaur nut, getting the big colorful books and that kind of stuff. But then during grade school, I don't really remember going there much. And then once junior high hit, and kind of maybe between, no, yeah, about junior high, I remember going back a lot. And I don't really know the reason for that. Maybe just free books. I don't know.
That'll do
but
it.
There was, yeah, the free aspect for sure. You know, when you're a kid, you have no money, of course. I don't remember the first Stephen King book I read, but an early one was definitely The Gunslinger. And that is not a typical Stephen King book.
So what's that one about, just in case people are listening who haven't read it?
So The Gunslinger is the first part of the Dark Tower series. And it's about this gunslinger named Roland. And he is traveling after the Men in Black. And you don't really know why. And it's very much a Western, but it's like a weird Western, where something, it's not, you know, 18 whatever, it's, you can't really tell what the time is. And as the book progresses, he finds this boy that's just kind of trapped somewhere, rescues him, and finds out this boy might be from a different world. And he's there. So him and this boy, the boy's name is Jake, and the gunslinger's Roland. And they go, and they're still going after this Man in Black, because Roland, he's kind of one-track mind. It's like, well, we got to keep going. Excuse me. And then they end up going on many adventures. And then in the end, there's this scene when Roland finally does catch up to the Man in Black. And there's this really kind of existential, like, vision thing happens. And it just kind of opens up into, like, this is a huge world. And we're just on this little tiny part of it. Not only is it a huge world, but it's huge, you know, multiverse, if you will. And I don't think I really understood that aspect of it the first time I read it. I was more into like the Western-y kind of adventures stuff. So that's The Gunslinger. And Jake, you find out, and I believe it's in that book, that he's probably from New York, or he thinks he's from New York, something like that. I don't remember exactly, because now he's revised the book and put it out again. I don't remember what he added and what Stephen King added to the book.
Okay.
Yeah, because he wrote that way back in the early 80s. And then after he wrote another, let's see, it was Gunslinger, Drawing of the Three, The Wasteland, Wizarding Glass. Wolves of the Kala, Song of Susanna, and then The Dark Tower. And somewhere around those last three books that came out, he redid The Gunslinger and kind of changed some of the language and kind of fixed it so it matched better with the rest of the series. I forget why I'm talking about this. What was the question?
I think I asked how you got into Stephen King.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I believe The Gunslinger was the first book that I read. But that's not a typical Stephen King book. A book that kind of affected me, and maybe this has to do with maybe I was going through, you know, puberty at the time, but there's a book called Gerald's Game. Have you heard of that one? Do you know that one?
I have not read that one.
Okay. So this is going to get a little dark, everyone.
Okay. We can handle it.
Okay, good. So Gerald's Game is about a man and a wife who decide they're going to get away to the cabin. Their marriage is on the rocks, I believe. And they're going to, you know, have kind of a pseudo honeymoon kind of thing. And they decide that they're going to get a little kinky. So she gets handcuffed to the bed and they're doing their thing. And Gerald, which is the man's name, I forget what her name is, he takes things too far. She kind of rejects what he's trying to do and ends up, you know, kicking him off of her. And then he has a heart attack and dies. So
wow.
She's chained to the bed and she's handcuffed to the bed. Her husband is there on the floor, you know, dead. They're in the middle of nowhere. They're on a cabin in the middle of the woods. You know, how does she survive? And so the rest of the book is kind of her in her own head, kind of dealing with what's happening. There's a lot of flashbacks to her childhood and just, you know, what happens? How does she get out of there? I guess maybe a running theme for a lot of these books that I become attached to is kind of survival. I like seeing these characters kind of put in these impossible situations and then them having to figure out using, you know, their wits or, you know, whatever Deus Ex Machina is there to get them out of what's going on.
I mean, I'm just wondering, the plot you've described, and then you preface it by saying I was going through puberty. Where are you in all of this? Like, as a teenage guy reading this book, like, what is this? How is this speaking to you? I guess I'm wondering.
Well,
are you trying to survive something in that period? Like, what's going on?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, aren't we all trying to survive puberty?
It's a dark time for everyone.
It really
very
is.
Very dark.
And there was a point where I definitely rejected my whole family and just said, like, I'm done with you guys. And okay, let me back up a little bit. So in the sixth grade, I broke my leg. I was playing ultimate frisbee with my class, made a jump, caught the frisbee, fell wrong, and snapped my femur in half.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. I was in a body cast, they put me in traction, and I was in a body cast for 5 or 6 months.
Wow.
Lots of books were read in that time. Some more R.L. Stein, actually. And so that kind of affected everything else. Like, after that point, the junior high I was supposed to go to started too soon, and I was still in physical therapy, so I couldn't go to that school. So I had to go to a school across town because they started like a month later.
Hmm.
So in junior high, I had no friends. I didn't know anybody. It was a kind of a fresh start. Plus, I had just relearned how to walk and jog and run. So yeah, it was very difficult. And that whole sense of survival, that was part of it. And then, you know, just junior high in general is hard. It's a hard time in everyone's life. Everyone's changing. You've got your hormones going everywhere. You know, it's just
discovering things,
you know, it's music and what's, you know, popular and not popular and that whole thing. It's chaos. And so I think maybe reading these books was a way to kind of get away from that and go into my own little world a bit. I did a lot of reading in that time period. The Stephen King, certainly, but also, again, Star Wars. There are a ton of Star Wars novels out there. And I would read those just one after the other as well. And those are kind of, you know, popcorn books where you just kind of read them and go, and there's nothing really deep in there. So, I mean, survival, was I surviving? I mean, yeah, I figured out a way to survive. Like I said, you know, I rejected my family at one point. My mother, specifically was always very much, you know, here's, do your schoolwork and you do your homework and I check it and I make sure it's good and you study for your tests, and everything was very, you know, regimented, which was, you know, I got a lot of good habits out of that. But after a while it became extremely overbearing. So in junior high, I proclaimed to her, from now on, I am not going to study for any of my tests anymore.
Oh, wow.
And that was, I was taking a stand. I planted my flag firmly in the ground, drew a line in the sand with my foot and said, no more. And, you know, and she was just like, you know, fine, you're going to ruin your life and blah, blah, blah. It was rough. It was a little rough. And, but for me, it was, look, all these tests I've been taking as a, you know, in elementary school, I studied so much, and it was, I'd study it just for the test and then the information would go away. And as a kid, I kind of recognized that it was just these cram sessions that would drive me nuts. Then I would get, you know, decent grades. I was an AB student most of the time. And then after that, I would just forget all the information. And I thought, like, that's not what school's supposed to be, right? Like, I'm supposed to be learning this stuff. It's supposed to stay in there. Like,
yeah,
I can, even now, I can recap books that I read, you know, 20 years ago. And I can't remember a single thing on a single test that I took in the fourth grade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I decided in junior high, that was how I was going to be my own individual. I was going to not study for tests anymore. And the grades that I got would accurately reflect how much I'd actually learned. And then we'll see how smart I really am.
Oh, boy.
And, you know,
how did that go?
It actually didn't do too bad. I maintained being about a B student. I would get the occasional A and I would get the occasional C, but I was pretty much, I would call myself a B student, which to me was acceptable, because if C is average, B is above average. So, and you know, my family wise, it was kind of like, yeah, okay. All right. I guess maybe we didn't need to push you as hard as we'd been pushing. And I was kind of like, yeah, that's right. I'm going to go read a book now.
So is that the extent of your rebellion against your family? No studying?
No studying. That was the big one. No studying. Oh, along with no studying was, Mom, you can no longer check my homework. That's what I do is what I do. So I think that was the big one until high school, when dating started. And that's a whole nother ball of wax, of course. But yeah, that was the big junior high rebellion that was me taking my life into my own hands, I think. And really that did affect a lot of what came afterwards, because that kind of informed how I approached high school with the, you know, no studying and all that. And again, I think I stayed mostly a B average student.
But so was learning for you something that was outside the classroom? I mean, you said you read a lot in that period. I'm sure the no homework policy freed up a lot of time for reading you rather be doing. So do you then understand learning as something that doesn't necessarily happen in school?
Yeah. Learning is, it's okay. So I always was able to retain more information when it was, when it was a lecture or a class where it was something that was like, here, check out, here's all this information and absorb it while I'm talking to you, that kind of thing. And so, you know, taking notes during lectures and all that kind of stuff, like that kind of, I kind of pulled back from that and just, instead of concentrating on, you know, writing down what was being said, instead I kind of pushed that aside and said, I'm just going to listen to what's being said. And so in a lot of in the classroom situation, I think that's what allowed me to kind of learn, because I was actually paying attention to what was being said, not paying attention to here's what I need to write down for the test later. And so I took that into life and said, OK, if my great grandmother is going to tell me a story about, you know, when she was a secretary in San Francisco, I'm going to listen to her because there's something I can learn from this. And so, you know, learning wasn't just in the classroom. Learning was every day. Learning was, you know, observing the world around you, actually opening your eyes and really seeing what's happening, and not just cramming for a test. Because to me that, and it's still, that's not learning. That's memorizing. And that's not something that we should be gauged on, I don't think.
So
memorizing.
You're not good at memorizing. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Fair. Totally fair. So I'm wondering then if you kind of felt, in a sense, this rebellious streak as a teenager, junior high person, about learning. Did you ever seek out any of like the stereotypical rebellious kind of novels that people typically map themselves onto in high school, like The Catcher in the Rye or anything like that, and think, yeah, that's me, or no?
Not really. It's interesting that you mentioned Catcher in the Rye, because I did enjoy Catcher in the Rye, but I was always, I never, all these absolutes. I didn't have a lot of friends who also read. And so in the pre-internet access days, I, you know, to go out and try to find something to read was just going to the library and reading titles and, you know, judging books by covers. And that's, you know, that's never good. So I didn't know that there were stereotypical like rebellion books like, hey, you know, you're at this age, you really got to read this. This is going to mean a lot to you. Like that never really happened. And I don't come from a family that, you know, while reading was important and it was emphasized from a young age, my parents aren't readers. Like we didn't have, you know, bookshelves, you know, cram packed full of books like how I do now. I've got like four or five bookcases throughout the house crammed full of books. And growing up, I never had that. I had what was in my room, and that's the only books that were around. Mm. So when it came time to like discover these books, it was just, I just kind of stuck to what I knew. So that's when I read a whole lot of Stephen King, and just about everything I could get my hands on, I tried to read of his. Michael Crichton as well, from the Jurassic Park days. Mm-hmm. I stuck with him a little bit. So yeah, no, to answer your question, no, there were no like the typical teenage rebellion books. I still, like, besides what you mentioned, Catcher in the Rye, what are the other ones? I still don't know.
Well, I mean, thinking, I'm just like circling back to Stephen King, because I know a lot of people that I've spoken to for this show and in life, Stephen King's work has meant a lot to people. And I'm wondering why it has spoken to you particularly.
It speaks to me particularly because I believe his writing isn't necessarily horror in the traditional sense. It's the horror of the real world that gets you. There are you know, monsters that pop out of the closet and that kind of stuff, but it's the way that people, how things affect them, the way people, these characters react to these insane situations they're put in. There's a reality there that is horrific, but there's truth in it. If you're gonna you know, gun down an entire small Western town with your 2 6 shooters because a couple people are attacking you for being the interloper, you know, the outsider, you know, how do you deal with that, you know, emotionally, and how do these characters react? And so to go back to the gunslinger, that's what happens in The Gunslinger. And, you know, he's regretting putting these people down, and he doesn't like the fact that he's so good at killing. It's something that he can do and that he's good at, but he doesn't like it. And, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. People every day, not just in the sense of gunning people down, but have to do things that they're good at, but they don't like. And just kind of, that's kind of the horror of our reality sometimes. And so I think Stephen King and his writing, there's a lot of stuff there that just spoke to me because it was telling the truth. It wasn't trying to, lighten things up or make things, you know, oh, everything's rainbows and unicorns everywhere and everything's going to be fine and A-okay. And in the end, the good guy is always going to win. It's no, life is hard. Sometimes things are horrific. Sometimes the good guys come through. Sometimes they don't. And, you know, that's kind of how life is. And I think that had a big effect on me with just kind of, you know, being able to experience those kinds of things before I was exposed to them in the real world. And I was kind of, it kind of prepared me a little bit for, like, you know, you don't get happy endings. Terrible things happen sometimes, but there are ways to get through it.
Hmm. Wow. That's really interesting. I'm wondering, no, it's true. And I think that is the appeal of a lot of his work, is that it doesn't give easy answers. Or at least that's what I've heard people say about his work.
Have you never read any Stephen King?
I have, but I haven't read, I'm not really a sci-fi person. So I've read Shawshank Redemption and things like that, but not, You know, like if I had to read it, I'd probably just start crying immediately. I hate clowns. Well, that's my nightmare.
The thing about it, and yeah, there are clowns, and clowns can be terrible, especially now since they're doing a remake of It and all that stuff. But the clown in It was just an example of this dark entity that is trying to seduce kids in any way that it can. And in the book itself, this It is, it's not just a scary clown. It's a number of things. It's just the clown is the thing that, since it was in that movie and how was it, Tim Curry mm-hmm. did such an excellent job of being this creepy clown, that's kind of what's attached to it now. But really that book is about, you know, this group of kids who all come from, or mostly come from, terrible family situations, just like all of us do. You know, all of us have, none of us have a perfect family, right? There's something. And so, you know, in the book, they're all amplified, but these kids come together and they become their own little support system. And then, you know, this thing kind of infests the town and they kind of take it upon themselves to try and do battle with it. If you've seen or know about, which everybody does now, Stranger Things on Netflix, to me, that had a very It vibe to it.
I'm wondering, you're talking about, you know, these kids creating a support system for themselves. And I'm remembering you saying that your parents don't read and you didn't have friends who read. So I'm wondering, like, did reading play that kind of role in your life? Was it a kind of support system?
Yeah, I think so. I've never really thought about it too hard. But yeah, you know, I always had a book. And I still always have a book. And when, you know, when, I mean, now I've got a 22-month-old child and a wife and everything else, but, and, you know, my wife is definitely my support system now, but there's, that book is always still there to go back to. And yeah, growing up, didn't have a lot of friends, but I had my books. I always had a book. That was me. There was a car trip, brought a book. Going to grandma's house, brought a book. You know, doing whatever, there's a book there in my back pocket. So yeah, for, you know, if books were taken away, I'm sure, like if a lot of people, if they were no longer able to contact their friends or family, it would be a very hard thing to deal with. And I think that's the same with me. If books went by the wayside, I don't know what I would do. Too much TV, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So when you were reading, who did you have to talk to about what you were reading? Because I think of so much of the life of a reader is it's kind of a solitary activity, but at the same time, it can be something that builds a bridge to other people. You can talk about a shared favorite book or something like that, or debate a book. So did you have the chance to do that when you were growing up, or was it just something that you kind of kept for yourself?
It was definitely something I kept for myself. When it came to the point where, well, you know, when I was in elementary school, sure, like, hey, you know, mom, this book is about this goo stuff that it's monster blood and it takes over things and blah blah blah, and okay, that's nice. But as I got older, it was like when I started reading the Stephen King specifically, like that was kind of taboo. Like, what I would go talk to my mom about, oh yeah, well, this woman was handcuffed to this bed, and she'd be like, what are you reading, and take that away from me. So I didn't want to put that kind of those books in jeopardy of, you know, being taken away. So I didn't talk about them very much. It was a very solitary thing. And like I mentioned earlier, I didn't have a lot of friends, and the friends I did have weren't really, you know, readers. So I didn't talk about books. I didn't debate books. And, you know, this is when we're, again, talking pre-internet age, where, I mean, you have to be in the same room to talk to somebody about something. And that just didn't really happen for me. High school, maybe when it like English classes and stuff, when we kind of were forced to talk on books, like that was really my first exposure to, like, you know, people can have different opinions about books and get different things out of books. And but then that's high school, and high school is a big popularity contest, so you have to be careful what you say. And so that's not as freeing as, you know, I'd imagine now in the age of the internet, where you can be anonymous online and just say whatever you want to anyone at any time. You know, that kind of thing, if I had that as a child, I would have been all over it, I think. Just like, I think this, I think that, you know, this is what I believe from this book and all that. But no, I had to keep it all kind of to myself and just would think about it over and over again. And I was a very quiet child. I think about my books.
Yeah. Hey, I hear you. I totally understand. Do you think, so we're probably roughly the same age. I don't know how old you are, but I remember very distinctly the internet sort of coming into my life. Mm-hmm. Well past when my love of reading was already pre-existent, and it was a big part of my life. Did the internet coming into your life change your life as a reader? So it was this solitary act. You didn't really talk about it with anyone. Did the internet compete with your attention for reading, or was it an outlet for you to connect with other people?
It was a bit of an outlet. It didn't really compete. Sure, I would go online and read some stuff, but I used it more as a tool to find more books. To go way back to Stephen King and his Dark Tower series, those books have lots of connections to other books. And if you want to say it, like all of Stephen King's books are somehow connected with either characters or themes or places or whatever. And I remember, you know, early on in the internet days, searching out websites that you know, documented these different things. So I'd find a website and I was like, okay, this character was in this book, but they were also in that book. And here's how the timeline works. And this location, some character did this place. And now that's the same place that a different character did something else in this other book. And so it was kind of a companion to my reading, I suppose, because I was able to do research, find books that I wanted to read. Maybe the like on different forums, there were suggestions like, oh, if you like these books, you might also like these other books. And of course, on those forums, and you got the hate of like, oh, these books are terrible. Why would you ever read that? Read this other thing instead. And, you know, at first you take offense to those things and then you go, OK, well, you know, let's see what are their points? What are they? Why do they think these are bad books? So the internet did not turn into like the friend that I always wanted to talk to about books. It was more like I was peeking into a different conversation that was already happening and just kind of absorbing different things that people were talking about with books. And, you know, then from there it turned into, you know, Kindle and getting books digitally and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And now I'm at the stage, and a lot of people are probably there now where it's like, yeah, people can say whatever they want. Doesn't matter. You know, people like to say all kinds of stuff on the internet. You can't trust half of it. And it's just there to try to become a viral sensation of some sorts. And, you know, a lot of it's kind of garbage.
Is there a book or book series or author that you feel personally offended if you see someone on the internet trash it?
Let me think about that. I don't think so, because, you know, I understand and I believe everyone has their own, you know, their different opinions on stuff. And, you know, certainly Stephen King gets a bad rap and he gets a lot of his own hate, which is fine. You know, but you can have your own opinions on different things. That, to me, that's not going to change what I personally got out of reading his books. So when someone goes online and trash talks, you know, a writer or a series or something, I'm like, okay, you know, you're allowed to have your opinion. It's kind of unfortunate that you're being this negative about it. But even the ones that aren't negative, it's like, okay, I can see somebody else's point of view. Like, if you're going to argue that, you know, George R. R. Martin is, you know, too violent towards women and gratuitous in his, you know, gory detail of the battles and stuff, like, okay, I can understand how people could believe that and not want to read these books. That's fine. That's A-okay. So to answer, like, no, it really doesn't bother me that other people have different opinions. It's fine.
So you mentioned Game of Thrones. I'm wondering, we talked about Stephen King, like, what other books and authors have meant a lot, can you think of, that define different parts of your life after the Stephen King sort of era?
So after the Stephen King era, let me think about that. That turned to Star Wars. Star Wars is a huge part of my life. I started watching Star Wars when I was in that body cast. That's when I was first introduced to that.
Mm. And how old were you when that happened?
See, that was sixth grade. I believe I was 12.
Okay.
And there's a ton of novels out there. There's, I don't know, 40 or 50 novels that you could read that all take place after Return of the Jedi. It's all been retconned now. It's a big mess. But at that time period, it was like novel after novel after novel. I read a ton of them. I still have them in a bin somewhere up in the attic. But that lasted me through into early high school. And then I want to say like mid to end of high school, that's when I probably read the least because I had a girlfriend. And we
didn't talk about books much.
We did not talk about books much. We got way into movies. So I kind of, my obsession of the, you know, of fiction moved from books to movies. I worked at a movie store, a rental store, and we would go out and watch movies all the time. And I'm still a big, you know, movie aficionado. But so that stage in my life, a lot of movies, not a lot of books. And then trying to think when I started a new like series, because the Dark Tower, there was a big break in it. After the fourth book, there were several years before the fifth, sixth, and seventh came out. Oh, I know. Harry Potter. That's the next one.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about your experience with Harry Potter.
So I first experienced Harry Potter when I was working at, let's see, I was going to ITT Tech. I was working at Hollywood Video. And
those were the days of video rental stores.
Oh yes, oh yes. That was the store that I was held up at gunpoint at. It's good,
what?
Good time.
What happened? Hold on, you have to tell that story.
Okay, So that one, it was a Wednesday night. I was on the closing shift. It was myself and a lady. She was, I was in my early 20s. She was probably in her late 20s, maybe early 30s. She had a couple kids. So yeah, late 20s. She was very short and petite, so age was kind of, I couldn't really tell, and I didn't ask because I didn't care. But anyways, we were working, she was the manager and I was there, and it was a Wednesday night, and I had put Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, up on the TVs to watch.
Of course.
Because the store was empty, and you know, why not? And so I'm watching that, and I can see in the corner of my eye that someone's coming up to the front doors. And so I turn to greet them as you're supposed to do. And he opens the door, and I notice he's wearing a big jacket. He's got a big thick beanie on, and he's got dark sunglasses on. And I thought, that's weird. And as I'm greeting him, he pulls out a large automatic weapon from his jacket, points it right at me, says, "Give me all your money." So because I was just like a counter jockey, I didn't have keys for anything. I couldn't open the drawer, but right next to me, you know, my coworker was there, and she did have all the keys. And so I just slowly, like, I was kind of, you know, you're in shock. So I slowly put my hands up, like in the typical, like, you know, I surrender position, and just kind of looked at her like, I can't do anything. And so she kind of freaks out, kind of starts half crying. Like, it hit her extremely hard. And so she takes the keys and opens up the drawer, and he says, "Put the money in a bag." And so I go reaching for a bag. Well, our bags were underneath the counter. And so he just saw me reach underneath the counter. And so then he like starts freaking out a little bit and is just like, "You know, what are you doing? What are you doing?" I was like, and I don't know why, but very calm, I said, "I'm just getting a bag. I'm just getting a bag. I'm just kidding." I just slowly pulled the plastic bag out.
Oh my God.
He grabbed the tray full of money and stuff and dumps it into the bag, takes a second one, dumps it in the bag, tells us to get on the ground. We both just, you know, lay down on the ground, and he says, you know, "Don't follow me or I'll kill you." You know, he's something very, you know, stereotypical. And out the door he goes. And so we're both laying on the floor staring at each other. She's in tears. And we're just like, in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, what do I do now? Well, now I got to call the cops. So I just reached into my pocket and just dial 911 from my cell phone, and we just stay on the floor. And as I'm talking to them, you know, we hear people returning their movies because there's a little flap from outside.
Oh, sure.
And so we just hear thunk, thunk, you know, thunk, thunk as I'm on the phone with 911. And, you know, so they say, you know, go lock the doors, you know, make sure no one else is, you know, is anyone else in the store? No, it's empty. You know, lock the doors. And she immediately calls her, I mean, she wasn't married, but her husband, her father of her children, her, you know, fiance, whoever he was. And this, he was a big dude. I mean, because she was small, he was big. And so I was kind of thankful, like, great, this big dude's going to come. That's kind of nice. So he shows up. I'm still on the phone with 911. I'm like, oh, my coworker's husband's here. I'm going to let him. They're like, no, do not let him in. And she's going for the door. I was like, no, don't. They say not to let him in. And she's like, what? I was like, just wait for the police. And so he just stayed right outside the door, just like sitting on the hood of their car with just this mean look on his face, like, because he wasn't able to come in. And then, you know, the police came, and in the end, everything was fine. You know, after we counted the drawers out, he only got away with about $300.
I was going to say, like, the wisdom of choosing to rob a video rental store. I mean, how much money did he imagine you had?
I don't know.
It's
I have
not
no
for
idea.
Us to say.
It was and the part that really boggled our mind, and especially, you know, the cops said this, is when I described the weapon that he had, which I don't know guns, but I, you know, described what it looked like, and they kind of sketched it out. I was like, yeah, it kind of looks like that. And they're like, oh, this is an automatic weapon. If we catch him, this automatically adds 5 years to his sentence.
Oh my
and he's
God.
Like, they were like, we don't know. This is crazy. Like, why would he do this? I mean, for $300, it makes no sense. Like, maybe he could have been extremely desperate, I suppose. But yeah, and apparently, when he grabbed the bag from my hands, he didn't get a good grip on it. So they were able to follow a trail of change in the direction that he ran out from the store. So comedy of errors, really.
Did they catch him?
Well, we don't know. A few weeks later, a detective came and said, you know, I'm working on the case from the blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay. Can you guys come? I'm going to ask you guys to come to the back with me. I've got a series of mug shots. You know, please don't talk about this, you know, with each other, because I don't want to, you know, skew the results. But excuse me, I'm going to show you some pictures, and just if any of them look familiar, just point them out. Okay, fine. So they take her back first, and she comes back, and then I go back, and it's a series of maybe 9 or 10 mug shots, and immediately one of them was like that guy right there. Like, even though they all kind of looked a little similar, there was one where it was like, yes, this guy right here. There's something about his face shape or whatever. Like, it was him. And he was like, okay, thank you. And that was it. I talked to my coworker later and was like, hey, when you looked at the picture, I know we're not supposed to talk about this, but when you looked at those pictures, was there one where you were like, yeah, definitely that one? And she was like, yeah. I was like, okay, cool. So my guess is we both, you know, pointed out the same guy, but we never heard anything back.
Yeah, that's like, weird. I thought you'd be called to testify or something.
Nothing whatsoever. Wow. We were never contacted. There was never anything in the mail. I mean, we wrote up these huge, like, you know, page long, exactly what happened, all these details. But no, that was it. To this day, I don't know what happened.
Steven, I'm not going to lie to you. The plot of that story, I imagine, rivals the plot of any film you could potentially rent from Hollywood Video.
yes.
And definitely. I say that as a one-time faithful customer of Blockbuster, your competitor. My apologies.
Oh, Blockbuster, come on.
Those were the days. I still have my Blockbuster card. I'm not giving it up. I'm just too sentimental. I hope it's going to come back.
It might be a collector's item one day. Did you see? I'm going to totally divert everything. There was something online recently where some people found a Blockbuster that when Blockbuster closed down, they just kind of locked the doors and walked away.
Oh my gosh. No, you have to send that to me. I'll put it on the website.
I'll see if I can find it. It's somewhere in the continental US. I don't know where, but apparently they just locked the doors and walked away when Blockbuster closed. Some people found it, walked in, and it was like a snapshot of the day that it closed. All the movies are still on the shelves. You know, it was
amazing.
Eerie. It was like a time traveling.
It should be preserved as a historic site. Let's hope.
to warn against what not to do.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know how we got off on this tangent, but I'm very happy I heard that story. And I'm even happier that you're okay and nothing no harm came to you as a result of that incident. But I think before we went down that rabbit hole, which I'm happy we went down, you were going to tell me about your discovery of Harry Potter.
Oh, that's right, Harry Potter. So, I had heard, you know, rumblings about this new book series that was super popular and everyone loved. And I was like, what's Harry Potter? What magic? Like, I'm not into that. I'm into science fiction. That's weird. And then the first movie came out, and in that Hollywood Video, one of my other coworkers, he was like, this is a great movie. You've got to watch this movie. And I was like, magic. I don't know. And he's like, no, I'll put it on, you know, one day when we're working and just check it out. And if you like it, you know, then because we got free rentals, then, you know, take it home and watch it. It's really good. Like, all right. So I'm watching it on the screen and it was like, you know, this is a decent story. You know, I'd never really been into any kind of fantasy before. And it seemed like an interesting story, and you've got this school and these kids, and they get into shenanigans, and that's fun, and you know the danger seems real, and that's kind of cool too, and you've got all these strong characters. Like, all right, maybe I'll check this out. Well, it wasn't until I want to say the fourth book released that I actually read the books. So I believe I watched the first and second movies. No, the third, because the third movie I absolutely love, and I still love it. Prisoner of Azkaban by Alfonso Cuarón. I love that movie, maybe because I'm partial to time travel stories, but I really loved that movie. And I think at that point I was like, you know, I really got to read these things, because the books are always better than the movies. Always. That's a rule. That's a life rule for everyone. The books are better than the movies. So at the time I was working in an office. This was way past Hollywood Video. I was working in an engineering firm, and we were able to, you know, listen to music in our headphones. And so instead of that, I started getting audiobooks. So reading shifted from, you know, book form to audio form for me. And that's when I decided, you know, I'm going to finally listen to these Harry Potter books everyone keeps talking about. And so I listened to those first four. Cause I think the fourth one had just released, I want to say. And after that, I was like, all right, I'm just going to go out and buy these books because I'm going to read these again. These are just well-written books. These are excellent. I'm way into this. This is great. I've never been into a fantasy story before, but that's all. It can work. It's not weird. I don't know why I thought it was going to be weird, but it wasn't weird. It was fun. From that point forward, I think it was the fifth, sixth, and seventh book. I was there day one at a bookstore to buy the hardcover to run home and read them. And of course, you know, we're there opening day for all the movies and all that kind of stuff, and looking forward to the new one. And I recently purchased the play for the eighth story and read that within a couple of days. Yeah, it's just good stuff.
What did you think of that?
I enjoyed it. It was a different type of story. I mean, I could see that it wasn't like directly from the mouth what's her name?
J.K. Rowling.
Yes. I know that the story was from her, but it wasn't like her voice wasn't really in the story to me. But because, you know, a second ago I said I was partial to time travel stories because I relentlessly watched Back to the Future as a child. That book, you know, or play, you know, spoilers, has some time travel-y stuff going on in it. And so that part I really enjoyed. Unfortunately, because it was a play and not a regular novel, you don't get the same depth from all the characters. And, you know, reading a play versus, you know, watching the performance, I'm sure there's a lot lost, because a lot of the characters would be defined by the performance more than just the words that they're speaking. So kind of missed out there. And so the characters themselves, a lot of them were kind of rough, if they weren't, you know, the original, you know, any of the original characters. But all in all, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good story. I like to give things a rating out of five, because a lot of people find that difficult. A five out of five being like the best, one out of five being the worst.
Okay.
I think when I, you know, gave that rating, I think I said it was a solid 4 out of 5, type story. I enjoyed it.
There you go. I'm wondering, you mentioned audiobooks. Is there something to be gained from listening to a book as opposed to reading it? Like, how do you experience, are there attributes to listening to a book that you prefer to sitting down and reading a book?
A lot of it kind of boils down to who's reading the book. There are some audiobooks where whoever's reading them just doesn't seem to mesh well with the content of the story, and others where it matches, you know, 1,000%, where it just kind of elevates the books in some sense. The gentleman who read the Harry Potter novels, and his name's escaping me right now. He did just the best job. He had a different voice for every child, for every character. And it was consistent throughout all the books. The way that he read, it matched the style of the book absolutely perfectly.
Hmm.
I recently listened to, Armada, which is Ernest Cline's second book. His first book was Ready Player One. And Ready Player One, I absolutely loved. I thought it was a fantastic book. And so the second one, it was right after my daughter was born. So I didn't have a lot of time to read. So I thought, I'm going to get this on audio and just listen to it while I can. And that was read by, what's his real name? The actor who played Wesley Crusher in the Star Trek. Will Wheaton.
Okay.
So, yeah, Will Wheaton read that, and he is big in, the nerd culture scene online. And so I thought, Ernest Cline's first book was very much nerd culture centric. The second one, reading the back cover looked like it would be too. It was very much The Last Starfighter, where there's a dude and he plays this video game and it's about, flying spaceships and killing guys. And turns out it was a training program, and now we really have to fly ships and kill bad guys. And so I thought, okay, well, that's very, kind of nerd centric as well. Maybe this will match. And it really didn't.
Hmm.
There was nothing wrong with his performance per se, but there was some kind of disconnect between the way he read and the way he read the characters and the source material itself. I don't know. I think there's a lot to be said for audiobooks. I love the audio medium. I mean, I'm doing a podcast now. I've got two of my own. I run a podcast network. Audio to me is wonderful. I recommend, audio for just about anything, but sometimes, just sitting down with a book, you might get a better experience just kind of letting your own head dictate what's happening and not somebody else's voice. But there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Hmm. Very cool. Very cool. And you mentioned that you like time travel, reading about time travel. Is that just fictional accounts? Or are you into the theoretical science of time travel?
The theoretical stuff, I'm into as well. Cause one of my other podcasts is a science and science fiction podcast. So we'll talk a lot of the science about that kind of stuff, but really it's the fictional stuff is where it gets fun because of paradoxes and the way that fiction deals with a paradox. For example, Back to the Future, most people have seen Back to the Future, that trilogy, and really that series is terrible with its timelines and the way that and cause and effect, but it's a good story and it has its own kind of logic that makes sense. If Marty, so Marty goes back in time on accident, changes how his parents didn't meet. So at that point right away, he wouldn't have existed. And then the timeline would have gone on without him. But then, if he didn't exist, then nothing would have gone back in time to have then stopped his parents from meeting. So then he would have existed. It doesn't make any sense. But that being said, it's a great story. There's actually a book, the Time Traveler's Wife. Have you heard of that one?
Yep. I read that book.
Oh, okay. So I really enjoyed that because you've got, even though it doesn't dive into the why of time travel at all, which a lot of times it's like, oh, there's a machine or it's a thing or it's a whatever. This one, they don't even try. It's like, well, sometimes I go back in time. It's like, oh, that's fine.
Trust me.
Trust me. I'm going back in time. Yeah. And I really like that they just kind of brushed that off in that book because that wasn't important. The important part was how you have, a relationship with this person that comes in and out of your life and you're at different ages and you have different experience levels. And it was just, to me, it was very interesting. I really enjoyed that book. Time travel, finding a good time travel story, I find is difficult. And I always point to Back to the Future, Time Traveler's Wife, and that third Harry Potter book as like my top three in fiction.
Hmm. Well, maybe I guess. Sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I guess kind of Terminator, but not really. It doesn't really count.
Yeah, well, the Terminator is always interesting.
Yeah, every time they reboot it and Arnold gets older, it's they have to find some reason why the robot's older, and it's gonna implode one of these days.
Yeah, I can't even imagine where that series is gonna go.
Full CG.
That's the future.
That has to be it. Just from the tip of his head to his toes, all CG, and then voice actors.
Well, the fact that you're a rereader, that you go back and reread books, that seems to me, too, like it kind of reflects your interest in time travel. Because, in a sense, every time you read Jurassic Park or something, it seems like you're traveling back to different versions of the person who's read those books before.
That's very true. And we know for a fact those books aren't changing. It's you yourself that's changing. And that's very interesting.
Is there a book that you've reread multiple times that you've had the biggest change of opinion about, or your feelings about it have changed a lot?
Well, I'm about due for another Jurassic Park reading, so I think I'll need to read that again maybe and get back to you. I actually haven't reread a lot recently. So to kind of go back to Harry Potter, I've reread and re-listened to those a few times. I think that's the last real series where I've kind of reread them a few times. And then I've kind of, when I discovered fantasy, that was like a whole nother direction for me to go in. And so the Game of Thrones thing kind of happened. There were some other books. Was it the Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear? Those are good books. And so I've kind of discovered, you know, there are so many books out there of so many, you know, of varying genres and ideas, and just there's so many out there that you don't have to reread stuff. Like, I think for a long time I was kind of stuck in this loop, my own little loop of like, okay, I like these, you know, five things, and I'm just going to try to, you know, recycle those as much as I can because I know they're good. I've kind of put that aside. Maybe this is part of getting past puberty and maturing a little bit. I don't know. I don't like to think that I'm a mature individual, but you know, when you experience something, it's kind of nice to say, I experienced this, and then I'm going to put this on the shelf. And that was my experience. Because we don't have that luxury of waiting a bunch of time and going back and rereading and waiting a bunch. Like, I can never do a Jurassic Park again. Right. I still have a long life ahead of me, so sure I could, but in my own head, I don't want to go back and, you know, reread, what's a book I read recently? Red Rising, the Red Rising trilogies. What's the guy's name? Something Brown, Pierce Brown. That's a trilogy I read recently that was very good. But that's like, I'm kind of done with it. Like, I read it. It was excellent. I really enjoyed it. And now I'm kind of done with it. And I don't know if I'd get anything out of it in another 10 years, another 20 years. I won't know until 10 or 20 years from now. It seems kind of, what's the word? I'm being dumb is what I'm saying.
No.
Yeah. In another 10 or 20 years, yeah, I'll be an extremely different person. And yeah, I will get other things out of those books. But I kind of like looking back on that experience that I had as kind of a moment in time, rather than something that needs to be revised every couple of years.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was mumbling to myself. I'm sorry.
So I guess, I mean, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but what are you reading right now? You mentioned some things, but is there anything that you'd recommend?
Let me ask you, what kind of books are you into? What genres are you a fan of?
I'll read pretty much anything.
Okay. In that case, the book series that I just mentioned called Red Rising, 5 out of 5, all three books, just an excellent book series. I was supremely surprised. My co-host on the science show that I do, he recommended the books. Hey, these books are pretty good. And we kind of have a very similar, bend on what we like. And so like, okay, I'll check them out. And the story is, it's essentially that same like Hunger Games type story where you have a group of kids that are thrust into this terrible situation of survival, again, survival, and they have to, you know, work their way through it. And in the end, you know, beat the system, and then it turns into something else. It's kind of that same thing, that same generic story that's been told over and over again. The twist with this one, though, is that the writer is able to give his characters such depth and be able to give them this sense of realness. It just it blew me away. He's not afraid of killing off characters that you love, which is just a terrible, awesome thing that some writers can do. you get immensely attached to these characters, and then you turn a page and they're just gone forever, and it's heartbreaking. So this writer's able to do that. You've got these scheming geniuses that you never know who's going to backstab who. The entire series is from one character's point of view. So it's you're in his head a lot. And just trying to figure out, like, he's trying, do I trust this person? Do I not trust that person? And the world, even when the main character is away from a situation, I have a feeling that this author, you know, has written other stuff that's happening. Because when they come back, when two characters come back after being apart and they talk about other things that have happened, like, it feels real. Like, I don't know how to explain it. So it's just one of those books where I would just hand it to somebody to read this. You need to read this right now.
Wow. Recommendation.
Yeah. That's my number one recommend right now for sure. It is science fiction, 100% science fiction, but it is definitely grounded in a kind of reality for sure. It never gets too fantastical. The couple of things that are, they're very singular and they're fantastical for a reason. It's a great government toppling work. I love it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate this. You taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Any time. I'd love to hear the sound of my own voice.
I'd like to thank our guest, Stephen, for sharing his story with us. If you'd like to check out his podcast, visit his podcast network website at bspodcastnetwork.com. You can also follow Steven on Twitter at SteveZero. That's StevezerZero. I'd also like to thank our technical director, Taylor, for all her help. You can follow us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123. And Taylor at MJT the PhD. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. You can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode. Thank you for listening.